This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design programme. I'm Josh Fennett. Now, welcome to a very special edition of this show, hosted this week from Monocle's bureau in Toronto. Coming up, January may be the coldest month, but it's design season in Canada's largest city. We'll meet the architects, designers and thinkers putting a spring in the step of Canada's design sector. So for the duration of the show, I'll be handing over to Monocle's faithful bureau chief in Toronto. It's our very own Tomos Lewis. Take it away, Tomos.
Thank you very much, Josh. Well, today we'll hear from the director of Canada's largest interior design expo.
We really want to be that key solution and ecosystem of design where we have opportunities for all sort of levels of design profession.
And do design weeks still have value, or have they become something of a bubble in which the great and the good of design are effectively preaching to the choir?
Toronto is North America's third biggest design city, so there's obviously a lot of design happening, but I think more closed doors.
All that, plus we'll hear from the Director of User Experience Design at Google on the independent studio she founded aimed at enhancing the inclusivity of design, and the Toronto-born product designer on his decision to relocate his studio from New York to his home city.
In spite of how much smaller Canada is, in spite of how much more insular it can feel, makes New York the insular place because there's so much concentration.
That's all coming up right here on Monocle on Design, coming to you this week from Toronto with me, Tomos Lewis. Well, it's January and the mercury has dipped to below 30 degrees Celsius already this year here in Toronto. But the great and the good of Canada's design sectors have ensconced themselves in the warmth of the exhibition halls and the unlikelier design exhibition spaces for what has been nearly 2 weeks of showcases of Canadian and international design. The annual interior design show known as IDS and the 10-day-long Design TO Festival, which takes place in unlikelier exhibition venues around Toronto, including the shop windows here at the Monocle Shop in Toronto, I should add, draws to a close today. Well, I'm joined now by my colleague Will Kitchens here from the Toronto Bureau, who writes widely for the design pages in Monocle magazine. Will, give us a quick sense of the design context, if you will, in which these design events that take place each January here in Toronto sit within.
You know, I think it's a pretty interesting moment for Toronto and Canadian design more generally at the moment. At least from a furniture and product design standpoint, there's a bunch of firms like Toronto-based MSDS or Tom Chung who have garnered a lot of international attention by going to some of the fairs over in Europe. And they've got quite a lot of Scandinavian licensing opportunities with major brands there. Lucas Pete, who's one of the founders of And Light, is here today too. They're a Vancouver-based lighting firm that's amassed a pretty wide-ranging and impressive list of American and international clients, and that's all based out of Vancouver. And then at a city level also, there is definitely some challenges facing the city. It's growing at a pretty exponential pace. And there's a lot of uninspired kind of glass condo towers going up, and there's a housing shortage too. So from a city standpoint, there are definitely some challenges facing the city. So that's why it's really interesting to have people here like Christopher Hawthorne, who's the newly appointed Chief Creative Officer of Los Angeles.
And when you say, you talk about sort of urbanism, glass condo towers here in Toronto, it's interesting. It struck me this year, having been in Toronto for these design events for a couple of Januaries by this stage, it strikes me that a lot of these events are broadening out, that they are seeing that design isn't necessarily sort of just the preserve of product design or of architecture in a traditional sense, that there's an intersection between, say, the development of a city or, you know, how we use the sort of infrastructure around us that is being discussed in a lot of these events this year. Would you say, you know, from your vantage point, having been born and raised in Toronto, does it feel as though the clout of Toronto as a design city in that broad church of the sense of design is sort of having a bit of a moment right now?
I definitely think so. You know, if I can speak about Canadian design more generally, which I guess is a difficult thing to do because it's so geographically diverse in such a young place, that means there's not a lot of historical infrastructure surrounding craft and making and anything like that. And historically, that's been a knock on the place, that there's not really much in the way of any sort of uniquely Canadian design identity or anything like that. But I think that's also a bit of a freeing thing. I think without having that traditional infrastructure, there's less dogma about how to do things. There's less entrenched ideas about how you should make and how you should design. And I think while that's also a challenge, that can be freeing and really lend itself to a lot of creativity. And I think as we kind of embrace that Canada is a young place and that its design history is naturally going to be quite outward and international looking, that naturally maybe it starts to produce a little bit more interesting things, and that it also starts to get a bit more acclaim on an international scale and acceptance too.
Well, Will, we'll be hearing much, much more from you throughout today's program. But for now, thank you very much indeed for speaking to me. Well, Toronto isn't the only city hosting design events this week. Design Weeks and design expos of all ilks have become big business for cities from Miami to Milan, from Lisbon to London. Often trumpeted as a driver of both a city's design pedigree and its wider economic fortunes, just how successful are Design Weeks at doing just that? Are they a useful tool in spreading the virtues of the best of design, or are they bubbles in which to preach to the converted? My colleague Will Kitchens has this report.
I'm here in Toronto's Metro Convention Centre for the first of 4 days at IDS. Now, in its 21st year, IDS has grown from an industry trade show into a more diverse design event that includes seminars, workshops, and lectures from a host of local and international speakers that make up a broad definition of what design is today. And while the show is keen to bring in international guests, its focus is still Canadian design, which, as Karen Kang, the National Director of IDS Canada, tells me, is in the ascendancy.
We are the champions of Canadian design, both locally and abroad. One of the key things for us is that we really want to be that key solution and ecosystem of design where we have, you know, opportunities for all sort of levels of design profession, whether you're a young student just trying to figure out what you want to do to when you're really, really established and you have new product or a new idea to share. We want to be that platform that you can have a voice in.
In recent years, cities the world over have been eager to attach themselves to a design-related festival, and today, more than 100 dot the annual urban calendar. While Milan shows are undoubtedly still design's most important annual destinations, as festivals and fairs have grown in popularity, there might be a downside.
Of course, there's the other end of the spectrum where, you know, a lot of designers are skipping Milan now because it is like a washer and dryer show place where it's become so culturally impressive that it's sort of been taken over by marketing.
That's Jamie Wolfond, the Toronto-born designer behind homeware and furniture brand Good Thing. While critics have argued that the popularity of design's biggest fairs have led to a takeover of satellite shows, media events, and major corporations, that doesn't mean fairs have lost their relevance. And that's especially true for Canadian designers. International design fairs are an important opportunity for those yearning for international exposure. Wolfond explains.
If you go do this show in Stockholm, you often come back with a lot of interesting licensing opportunities. And that approach now has been used by several other designers. I'm planning on going to Stockholm with all of this work. And so, you know, in a way that could become a Canadian approach, which is very different from New York, where the market for expensive things is so large that you really don't have to look further than the very city that you're in. Actually, in some ways, in spite of how much smaller Canada is, in spite of how much more insular it can feel, makes New York the insular place because there's so much concentration. It's like an echo bouncing off the walls in a very small room.
Despite the relative infancy of many of Canada's design sectors, that can offer, according to Wolfund, a distinct advantage.
It seems like Canadian design is inherently international. There are more Canadian designers who I admire licensing with European brands, which is kind of what every industrial designer wants to be doing right now, particularly with Scandinavian brands, than there are in New York.
Beyond the confines of Toronto's convention center, and spread across unlikelier locations across the city, is the DesignTO Festival. Spanning 10 days and some 140 design projects, it's Canada's largest festival of design. And the event's goal is to remove design from its studio confines and open it to the public. Among the unlikelier exhibition spaces are the windows of the Monocle Shop here in Toronto, which I'm standing outside now. looking at the lighting installations of the Z Design Studio, which have taken over our shopfront for the duration of the festival.
Go back to 2011, now we're in our ninth year, and for that there was just a small group of people doing design-based exhibitions, I would say in a very kind of public-facing way. Of course, Toronto is North America's third biggest design city, so there's obviously a lot of design happening, but I think more closed doors.
Deborah Wang is Design TO's artistic director.
There are so many common things that we share across disciplines and also beyond. And so, you know, even scientists thinking about, you know, like what they're thinking about, we're thinking about too in design. So there's that opportunity to have that conversation and make those connections.
Design TO says that 500,000 people have experienced the festival in some way since it began 8 years ago, which, the organizers say, has also added some $13 million Canadian dollars, or 8.6 million euros, to the city's coffers last year alone. Those numbers certainly pale in comparison to the economic impacts of equivalent expos in Milan, Eindhoven, or Paris. But younger design weeks, like that wrapping up for another year here in Toronto, is a good example of what a design week can be for a city. A showcase for local designers, and an opportunity to foster conversation and collaboration with those for whom design may otherwise be out of reach. For Monocle, at IDS in Toronto, I'm Will Kitchens.
Will Kitchens, my colleague here at Monocle's Toronto Bureau, reporting there. You're listening to Monocle on Design here on Monocle 24 with me, Thomas Lewis, here in Toronto. Is design an inherently exclusive realm? Well, that's the question that our next guest posed when she established her studio, Mismatch Design, which explores how design has often excluded large numbers of people, particularly those with disabilities. Kat Holmes is the director of user experience design at Google, having previously led the inclusive design team at Microsoft. My colleague Will Kitchens met Kat Holmes here in Toronto, and he began by asking her to define what inclusive design means to her.
How I've come to understand inclusive design, how I think about it, it is a method for considering the full range of human diversity when we design solutions. And in particular, it starts with designing with, in partnership, excluded communities when we think about how to create solutions and environments.
And when you talk about excluded communities, what might those entail?
Certainly how I learned inclusive design was first thinking about ability and disability. So people who experience exclusion based on disability, maybe low vision or blindness, someone who uses a wheelchair, kind of the more traditional categories as we think about disability, but It expands much more broadly to different types of cognitive, social exclusion. And really the heart of it is how we think about mismatches that people might experience when they interact with the world around them. So we can all experience mismatches in different ways, but there are people that experience mismatches on a regular, daily, consistent basis. The World Health Organization defines disability as a mismatched interaction between the features of a person's body and the features of the environment in which they live, which is an evolution from thinking about it as a personal health condition. And this social model of disability then makes it possible to think about all the ways that we would rethink the percentage of the population that experiences mismatches and experiences disability. The World Health Organization also, 2011, they published a report on prevalence of disability in the world. Over 1 billion people have a disability of some kind, at least one kind, around the world globally. So it's a very large, it's 20% of our population. At any given moment, as you mentioned, you know, through our lives, we're gaining abilities, we're losing abilities as we age or we're injured and illness. So when we start to frame it in those terms, we start to really realize it's all in each of us. And the key is to think about a specific environment or a specific solution that we're working on and the many different facets of exclusion or mismatch that people might face. We start to think differently about segments of population. So rather than it being some small category, it becomes a continuous kind of way of interacting in the world and who might be passing through either permanently or temporarily that state of mismatch. It can end up being a very large market opportunity.
And within the design process, where does that element of exclusion really, do you think, come from? What is it rooted in?
There's a big culprit. One of the biggest culprits in my mind is what I'd call an ability bias. So that as a designer or an engineer or a builder or a solution maker of any kind, when we use our own abilities to create those solutions, you know, we design something that we ourselves can see or hear, or it matches how we learn, our learning styles, that plays to the biases of our own abilities. And that then leads to solutions that work well for somebody who has similar abilities or similar preferences, but it ends up excluding a much broader group of people, both because of a mismatch in ability or because, you know, in a situation or temporarily, maybe, you know, what we can see and hear changes. So it may have been designed, a solution may have been designed in a perfectly lit environment with a quiet surroundings, but then when that goes on and out into the world and is used in a crowded pub or a subway station or on a bus, suddenly that design becomes inaccessible. Sometimes it's easy to fall in love with the object, to fall in love with the outcome, and to debate the outcome endlessly without giving thought to the steps that led to that or whose voices are strongest in the room and whose voices might be missing. There's a long history of inclusive designs that are working quietly in our everyday life. One of my favorites is the keyboard, the typewriter. The first typewriter was designed in the mid-1800s by an Italian inventor named Pellegrino Torri and a countess named Countess Carolina Fontani de Fivizzano. And the two of them were very close friends and some folks rumored lovers. So the Countess was blind, and when, you know, at this time, if you wanted to communicate by letter, you know, when they were apart, the Countess would have to dictate to another person who would write that letter down, which is not a good solution at all if you want to keep your communication private. And so the two of them worked together to invent what's known as the first typewriter prototype, which made it possible for the Countess to author her own letters. And so what I love about that example, you know, keyboards, typewriters have gone on to many different permutations and generations that we've all benefited from in some way. There's a long history of examples like that. The first flexible straw, email, audiobooks, all of these started with a design that was created in partnership between someone who experienced a mismatch and exclusion and then thinking about how that solution could work for a much broader group of people.
And while inclusive and exclusive design obviously have a very, very long history, to have it be an explicit industry, an area of design, is a bit of a newer thing. What are some of the challenges or the great and exciting things about being kind of at the forefront of navigating that?
There's a long history there, but bringing it to the, I think, corporate world, to the public sector, to how we solve our own daily kind of solutions is the real tipping point that we're seeing right now as it becomes, inclusion becomes a topic of conversation at a much broader scale. The challenge, the biggest challenge in making that a default way of working as a designer or an engineer versus making it a specialization, I would always prefer that it be a foundation that any designer starts with, and that as much as we think about good human-centered or human-led design, that inclusion is a principle of that, and the practices come along with it no matter what field you study.
Kat Holmes there, founder of Mismatch Design Studio and director of user experience design at Google, speaking to Monocle's Will Kitchens. Among Toronto's ascendant roster of designers making their mark in a huge variety of design fields, both here in Canada and around the world, is Jamie Wolfund. Born in Toronto, he launched Good Thing, a manufacturer of everyday design objects, from household trays to side tables, back in 2014. I spoke to Jamie at last week's IDS Interior Design Expo here in Toronto and began by asking him about Good Thing's beginnings.
I studied in Rhode Island at the Rhode Island School of Design. And when I first graduated, I wanted to be an independent designer. And so I started designing work for licensing with manufacturers. And I was quickly sort of frustrated by the opacity of that experience. As a very young and very inexperienced designer, there isn't a lot that you can do to get things into production at the beginning. There are a lot of dues that have to be paid. I was a little bit impatient when it came to those. So I sort of said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to start making these things myself and selling them. And before long, I had solicited friends to also design things for my brand, which soon became Good Thing, which at first was a home goods company and later grew into a furniture and home goods company, which sold both wholesale and retail, primarily to the U.S. market, but ostensibly all over the world.
In terms of the early frustrations as a designer of sort of getting your things, of getting a brand sort of in the marketplace, you created it, you say, to, as I guess, a bit of a protest about the sort of the behemoth of the way the sector works. But what were the kind of challenges and the sort of frustrations that kind of going it alone, going solo, confronted you with?
You have to deal with a lot of failure, which is sort of ends up being the fuel for success in a certain way. But reaching the American customer with our products was hard. The American customer is not necessarily the most adventurous when it comes to what they buy. And so over time, we had to come up with products that would have the level of depth and sophistication that we identified with, but also operate on this other level and sort of speak to both a average Joe kind of customer and a design aficionado. An example that I often like to use is our Frank tray, because that was the first product when we really figured out how to straddle the design aficionado and the greater U.S. market. And so the Frank tray is basically, we made it as a test before making a dustpan, also designed by Chris Spies, who is one of my former professors. It's basically this metal forming detail that we often see on industrial product, elevated to become an almost Baroque detail. And for us, it's about that interesting tension, that push and pull. But, you know, sort of after we designed and made it, we realized that it looks like a hot dog tray. And that's kind of the accidental genius of that product, is that we don't have to discuss it looking like a hot dog tray. We chose a name that was moderately alluded to it being seen that way, but we were able to reach these two very different customers with one product. And that is totally necessary if you want to try and sell the kinds of things that we wanted to sell to, the market that we wanted to sell them to. Ultimately, because the heritage and history of design is so much shorter in North America than it is in Europe.
Now that you'll be swinging your, you know, energies, as you say, back to your own studio, are we to expect a sort of shift in sort of gear, shift in the kind of design, or, you know, what kind of forum do you want that studio to be now that that Good Thing is sort of, you know, in a different sort of chapter, I guess?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it gives me the chance to play some of my radical skepticism somewhere new. So that means I can make things that I think probably wouldn't sell. And that's a huge amount of freedom for me. Of course, with Good Thing, and when I would design a product for Good Thing, there would always be a push and pull of like, well, this is what I really want to make, and this is what I think I can get the market to adopt. There would often be products that I designed that I very much liked that I could not do anything with because they don't necessarily suit the brand that I had already built. So being able to continue managing that and simultaneously make this other work that will be probably a little bit weirder is a really awesome gift.
And how would you say your assessment of like the space for young designers trying to go it alone as you did all those years ago? Is it kind of a cluttered space? Is it getting saturated from one corner or the other? Or is it a particularly exciting time where if you've got the sort of get up and go, not to over romanticize it, but if you have got the get up and go, there is actually, it's a pretty ripe time to go and do it?
I think it's always a ripe time for people who are extremely motivated. And, you know, the people who stay in design, which is a hard profession to make money in, are people who, for the love of design, couldn't possibly be doing anything else. But it doesn't seem to be a particularly fruitful time to be a designer. I think it used to be that licensing careers were made with a single product. I don't see that kind of thing happening for young studios very much anymore. That seems like a big change. think at the end of the day, at least from being the experience of being the creative director for Good Thing and receiving the emails from the thousands of designers who want this, making great work is always going to be more important than sending a lot of emails or branding your studio in a particular way. And I think the designers who focus on making good work and thinking critically, and that's really critically, and that means designing things and then throwing them out and then designing them again and then throwing them out again. And after 10 redesigns, deciding that it's just not a good enough product and moving on to the next thing, the designers who can do that will always find a certain kind of success.
The designer Jamie Wolfand there speaking to me during this year's IDS Expo here in Toronto. Well, to round off this week's special edition of Monocle on Design here from Monocle's Toronto Bureau, I'm joined once again by my colleague Will Kitchens. Will, you've spoken to a huge array of figures from an equally impressive array of design sectors over the past 10 days or so. What are your key takeaways from this year's design events here in Toronto?
I think what struck me the most was something that you actually touched on at the top of the show, and you mentioned the diversity of what is going on here and also the diversity within the shows. And I think that's especially obvious at IDS, what started, I guess, 21 years ago as a interior show and what was firmly a trade show has really kind of expanded its mandate into becoming something more interdisciplinary. So instead of furniture designers or interior designers, we have those still, but there's also architects, there's city builders, there are people doing wholly new industries like inclusive design, as we heard from Kat Holmes. And I think that's a really important thing. And I think that also reflects a growing maturity of Toronto's design scene. And I think to really have a design week and a design festival be valuable to a city, to have those cross-disciplinary conversations is a really important thing. And to really glean something from it, I think we need that. And I think that's a important element of growth that we've seen here.
Will Kitchens, thank you very much indeed. Well, that is all we have time for this special edition of the programme from Toronto. So for now, from me, Thomas Lewis, it's back to you at Midori House in London, Josh.
My sincere thanks to Thomas Lewis. Wasn't it great to hear from him? And Will Kitchens too. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our Natalie named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You can also download it as a podcast thereafter. And of course, why not pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is available on all self-respecting newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced and edited here in London by Daphne Karnesis and the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.